I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Today on Change Surfer, we'll be listening to the first part of a panel that was held at BosCon, the Boston Science Fiction Convention, on February 19th, 2006. The panel was Cyborgs, After Man and Beyond, and it included Cory Doctorow, Robert Katz, Carl Schroeder, Charlie Strauss, and Alicia Kestrel-Verlager, and yours truly. Speaking first is science fiction novelist Robert Katz.
The cyborg is an old idea in science fiction, but until fairly recently, it seems to me that we were talking more about physical enhancements than mental enhancements. The bionic man, the person with artificial limbs that would be stronger and faster and better than the regular, maybe the person with an artificial heart. In my own book, the protagonist gets a titanium skeleton and a plastic membrane skin. But these days, people seem to be focusing more on cognitive enhancements, cerebral enhancements, so much so that virtual reality is becoming indistinguishable with normal reality. And our characters and protagonists and antagonists have great and strange powers in this virtual world.
I actually ascribe to the cognitive psychologist Andy Clark wrote a book called Natural Born Cyborgs, and he makes an interesting distinction in saying that many of us are cyborgs now because we've already integrated our technology into the way we think and the way it affects our everyday lives. And he speaks as someone who doesn't even wear glasses, which a lot of times I use glasses as an example of a prosthetic and how people integrate their prosthetics. But a lot of people outside of fandom refuse to even accept the word prosthetic in reference to anything that they use, such as their glasses, their contacts, whatever. So in reality, I would say that cyborgs are here now, and that the technology, there is a cognitive aspect, but it has to do with the fact that once you have that technology, it changes the way you think.
I've got one of the residents in my program. He's a first-year anesthesia resident who lost his leg a few years ago playing high school football. Pretty horrible injury. And he has a prosthesis, which he does not use as fully as he could and probably should. But I find it very interesting that similar prostheses are now used by soldiers, and the government feels that they are good enough to send soldiers back and fight in Iraq with artificial limbs. And that's a tremendous advancement in prosthetics. I did not think we would ever reach that far realistically, but we have. The one thing that these prosthetics lack, it seems to me, is real biofeedback. They're not a part of our nervous system, at least not yet. They have their own self-contained controls. They react very well to pressure, but they are not directly controlled by the brain. And it seems to me that that's when cyborgs will be real. Instead of just a physical add-on, it'll be a mental add-on.
But once you have a prosthetic, the idea of biofeedback as being something directly linked to your brain, I think, becomes more abstract. The way I use my computer to do things that other people take for granted, in scribbling down notes or whatever it is they do, people constantly assume that I can't do something. They hand me a piece of paper and then say, oh, but you can't read this. And, you know, I have a series of scanners and computers and things, and I can read that. And I think the same is true of interacting with your environment. I use my cane. Other people use their prosthetics or their wheelchairs. I think it's very interesting as a topic of discussion, but I think I would come down on the side of I'm not sure that level of biofeedback is necessary.
All right.
Actually, there's a philosopher in England named Carl Schroeder, by the way. I'm a little bit late because I got really late in the hallway. A philosopher named Andy Clark.
Yes.
Natural born cyborg. What's that?
Yeah.
Okay. And he claims that, there's a lot of empirical evidence for this, that cognition and consciousness are extended into the environment. They're not things that happen in a black box in the head. So the idea that what you need to do is put a socket in your head and plug things in is completely incorrect. Anybody here heard of the Asperger's phone?
Yeah.
It's a telephone with a couple of LEDs on it.
I judged the competition that came from.
Okay, yeah. It's a very simple device. For people who have Asperger's syndrome, which means they have a difficulty parsing social and emotional cues from other people, the phone interprets the tone of voice and volume and other cues of the person on the other end of the line, and then will show by color on the phone whether that person is, for instance, angry or happy, or in other words, give the person with Asperger's the context for understanding where they are in the conversation. This is a prosthetic that lives outside of the brain.
Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in the way that tools change cognition. And I think that that's a way that prosthetics and your gray matter interact that's not visible, not immediately visible. I think, for example, the ancient Greeks were able to tell stories in which they had a deus ex machina ending, where the gods came and changed things to resolve the plot, and have those be satisfying stories because the Greeks didn't have a very sophisticated notion of causality because they didn't have good instruments. And I think that, you know, if anything is responsible for the end of the deus ex machina, it's the microscope, right? It's the ability to observe the natural world in detail and understand causality where none had appeared to be to the naked eye, to the unassisted, non-prosthetic human. A friend of mine recently had a rare earth magnet about the size of a lighter flint implanted in her right index fingertip from a shop in Tempe, Arizona. If any of you are going to the Nebula Awards, I'm thinking about getting this done if I make the final ballot. If anyone's going, we should do a field trip to get these magnets implanted. And just as you can tell whether something is heavy or light or smooth or rough, she could tell whether something was ferrous or not. It gave her another sense, and so she could tell when she was walking near a shoplifting detector, and so on, you know, when she was near magnetometers, and she could tell when she picked up cutlery, well, it's cool, it's smooth, ergonomic, and it's steel.
Neat. That's terrific.
In the transhumanist parlance, we talk about the opposite of transhumanist assumptions being bioconservatism. And for me, what's very interesting is to parse the way that cyborgs and all kinds of human enhancement and bio-others are treated in science fiction in terms of whether the enhancement or the cyborg technology is the MacGuffin for the story, that it drives the story in some way that is horrific. You know, that the person wants to live forever and that causes terrible consequences for them and others, the story of Dorian Gray or Frankenstein, that they get a chip in their head and then they start having seizures like in Terminal Man.
Right.
Or if the author has sufficiently incorporated the notion of the inevitability and desirability of some of these enhancements, that they make that a part of the universe and then make the story revolve around other things, other aspects of life in that kind of a universe. And I think, you know, looking at it from that point of view, since we are in a point in history when different kinds of cyborgological enhancements are with us and going to be ever present, you can imagine that we have the same obligations as critics and consumers and producers of this kind of fiction to not reinforce negative stereotypes about people with cyborgological enhancement. And yes, I see Charlie grabbing it.
Yeah, something I'd like to raise, though, is the flip side of it is the ethics of who controls cyborg enhancements. One thing that I haven't heard of any prosthesis doing is self-healing. It's not just being able to provide feedback direct into your nervous system, it's also a degree of self-repair that we expect of our own limbs. Mm-hmm. Again, use of artificial limbs for soldiers who've been maimed in a battle that are now considered good enough to send them back into combat, you can argue that these soldiers have a very interesting choice. They can either decline to have the augmentation applied, in which case they're basically combat pensioners or somewhat injured, mm-hmm. or if they take advantage of it, they may regain some of their faculty, but at risk of death. because somebody else is controlling access to it, because these are pretty expensive gadgets. Mm-hmm. We can go a step further. When you start integrating bits of equipment into your body or into your mind, you are almost certainly allowing whoever is providing it to have some degree of control over your body. Something we haven't seen happening yet. We've seen, for example, the tags for criminals to sort of require them to phone home or to track wherever they are. One thing that has been suggested some time ago is the idea of GPS-enforced slavery.
Right.
The idea being there is a GPS receiver on that tamper-proof ankle tag and an electric shock machine. If you go somewhere where you're forbidden to go, it'll give you an electric shock.
Right.
That you might consider to be some kind of coercive enhancement. So we've got ethical issues here, because you then get issues of ownership. We take it for granted that we own our own bodies. When our bodies start becoming blurred with bits of environment around us or bits of machinery, who owns it?
Another interesting aspect to that is most of the research, if not all, currently being done regarding prosthetics is being sponsored by the Department of Defense. And all of us who are reading these stories note at the end that the Department of Defense is consistently interested in not just prosthetics, but human-computer interfaces, research studies which are consistently using people with disabilities to further the research. Now what happens is the person with a disability can only participate for so long due to all sorts of study regulations. They're sort of, you know, set aside, and the government finds, you know, more guinea pigs. So there are various questions about who's really benefiting and what is the ultimate, you know, even what is the most agenda for this kind of research, because ultimately a lot of these people getting the prosthetics got them because they were sent, you know, to wars, and the level of amputees is only increasing with each war. So, you know, more study subjects.
I love how in Citizen Cyborg there's that great discussion of how the have-not, if I remember this correctly, the have-not gap is going to be between when you were born, because Moore's Law will determine how much of the genome we understand on a generational basis, and therefore which things we can select against as we tweak our, you know, do in vitro fertilization and selection or what have you, so that, you know, there'll be a cohort born after heart disease is cured. There'll be a cohort born after certain kinds of cancer, genetic cancer are eliminated, and so on. And they just will grow up without these impacts. And it won't be whether you're born in a poor or rich part of the world, but a poor or a rich era.
I find that, I'm sort of a scientist. I mean, I'm an academic physician. I've got 20 scientific papers. I've got 10 book chapters. And I do enough research to know that most research turns out negatively. Most of the time when you ask a question and you do set up an experiment to get to the answer of that question, the results are not positive, they are negative. And that's just the way it is. When we do research on human beings, all consent forms that I know of have a little disclaimer saying you will probably not benefit from this research. And we ask people to participate in the research because, number one, it'll help our career. Number two, maybe there's an off chance it'll advance human knowledge. But I think usually if we're being honest with the patients, and I think usually we're honest, we're very upfront about the fact that they themselves might not get any personal benefit out of it. And I don't see anything wrong with that. And I think that it's inevitable. I know of no other way to do the experiments. So that this idea that the Department of Defense is involved, I personally do not think that that's a negative. Somebody's doing the research, that's good. And when the Department of Defense comes out with their prostheses that help their soldiers, those prostheses will trickle into the civilian population, and people who need them will get them. The resident anesthesiologist I mentioned is a case in point. 20 years ago, what he's using on his leg simply did not exist. Probably 5 years ago, it did not exist.
How do you do that?
It's interesting for me because now there's the there's retina chips, which can be used by people who have functional retinas, which I do not. But I get approached by strangers on the street asking me basically when I'm getting that chip in my head.
Interesting.
And I am simultaneously fascinated and appalled as a science fiction fan. Of course, you know, getting gadgets implanted used to be fun to say I wanted one of those. But now that there's sort of this cultural idea that I should just go ahead and I'll be ultimately fixed, I feel very resistant to it. Yeah, I don't want people messing with my wetware. That's where I draw the line, you know. I want to be able to put it down, and I want to know what's on that chip that they're, you know, do I know everything on the chip that's being implanted? So
the people who make it don't know everything that's on it either.
Today on Chain Surfer, we're listening to the first part of a panel that was held at the Boston Science Fiction Convention, BosCone, on February the 19th, 2006. On the panel are Cory Doctorow, Robert Katz, Carl Schroeder, Charlie Strauss, and Alicia Kestrel-Verlager, and yours truly.
I think, actually, Charlie's concept of the exocortex, which I'm sure has precursors, is an important thing to introduce because many of us will find that kind of increasing cyborgological dependence on the information devices that we routinely have at our fingertips as equally dependent as something in our head. But back to an earlier point about the military, about individual liberty, about whether the inequality between nations will be important, which I do think it will be important. I think the general point that's important for the social policy around cyborg devices, as well as for the fiction around them, is that the real problem is not the technology itself. The problem is the social arrangements, whether we have cultural and political institutions that protect liberty, that ensure equality. And if you look at it from that point of view, these latest enhancements go back in a continuity with questions that have been raised for thousands of years. You know, the problems of battlefield triage and the ethics of sending soldiers into war is not a new problem with prosthetic limbs. It goes back for thousands of years.
Another interesting point about prosthetics, there's a book which does a historical perspective of the development of prosthetics. Right now I'm blanking on the name of it, but an interesting aspect is there are social distinctions, class distinctions, in what a prosthetic should do. For the upper classes, for the middle class, the distinction is that it should look normal. It should make that person indistinguishable. For the lower classes, it's about work. It's about getting work and being able to do a job and fulfill your duty to, you know, your society. And that's another thing that I think is still very, very, very here and now, very much a part of how those innovations are being discussed.
It's my personal belief that technology is legislation, and therefore, to introduce a piece of technology is the equivalent to legislating a particular social change. A good example is the pill. When you introduce the birth control pill, you are actually legislating a female workforce. So the introduction of prosthetic technologies is not neutral. In fact, you can talk about society deciding how to accommodate these things, but in fact, the technologies themselves, when they become available, make the decisions for us. And that's an aspect of technological adoption that is not discussed or really understood in our society, and hence makes this whole issue a lot more dangerous than it might otherwise be.
There's also, I think, issues of self-identity. Most of us are sort of fairly attached to our own self-image or have fairly strong opinions as to whether we're pretty or ugly, for example, whether we're overweight or underweight, or whether our bodies function as we want them to or not. Again, with the whole prosthetic or cyborg enhancement thing, we have fairly fixed ideas as to what human beings look like. if we go and envisage sort of a far future where we have people who, for example, have been surgically modified to operate in a vacuum,
that's right.
Do we run the risk, because of our own innate prejudices about what human beings look like, of ending up with creating new forms of, I guess, racist prejudice against these people who don't look human? Mm-hmm. Will, if these people are effectively drafted into it, again, as in the case of US servicemen being sent back into battle with prosthesis, are we in fact creating a situation where we're taking people and depriving them of, if you like, the human right to be human?
Well, then we have to talk about what's human, and that was another panel. That was Friday night. So
I'm really fascinated by which kinds of personal enhancement are considered moral and which ones are the subject of moral panic. Like, no one argues about the immorality of LASIK, even though some fraction of LASIK surgeries end in blindness.
Right.
And wedding yourself to LASIK means that you're wedding yourself to technology in 2006, and with the understanding that in 2026 it will be substantially advanced over that. And people get LASIK and they ask for better than normal vision, and we don't complain about it. But take a neurochemical, or take a chemical that is intended to change the internal state of your brain, surely the area where you should have the most liberty, and it's the subject of tremendous moral panic. I personally try to minimize my intake of things that alter my brain chemistry apart from food. I don't take caffeine or any kind of narcotics, but I have been known to indulge in both on occasion, and I honestly don't understand how it is that something as invasive as LASIK can evince no moral judgment, and something as transitory as LSD can cause us to fight literal wars with human casualties.
Corey, LASIK is fundamentally just another step on from contact lenses, for a step on from the spectacles you're wearing. It seems a less intrusive replacement for your spectacles.
LSD is a step on from caffeine and liquor.
But there's also...
I think maybe the difference is you can make your own LSD, but you can't make your own LASIK.
Well, also LSD... LASIK surgery is a functional enhancement. It makes something that you do, it enables you to do it better. I don't know that LSD does that.
There's an interesting person called Amy Mullins, who is a double amputee, lost both her legs. And she's been discussed quite a bit, at least in cultural studies and in disability studies, because she has a selection of legs according to which persona she is enacting at that moment. She is a cover model. She is she has a pair of what she calls Barbie legs. They're glass. They were made by an artisan. And then she has a pair of, I forget if they're called cheetah legs or jaguar, but she's a professional runner with these, you know, bionic legs. And I think one of the things that comes out in people in the anxiety around such discussions is very much an idea of passing. You know, we are willing, society is willing to approve of prosthetics which ensure us that other people look more like us, but when they stand out, we're a little uncomfortable with that, let alone might have a better chance of getting a better job than us, making more money, being more famous, being more glamorous. Whatever, having a bigger family. And I think that at some level that's what's going on. There's cultural anxiety.
Society hates cheaters in a genetic sense. We're genetically programmed to hate cheaters. It may be that that is a perception of what's happening. And it may be that that is a perception of the transhumanist future, that such people are, genetically speaking, cheaters. Therefore have to be taken down so that we can pass on our own genes.
This is going to be a big problem. I mean, if anybody thinks that sports are a problem or deserve to be a problem, but for the sporting industry and the sports fan, artificial enhancements that make us better than we started are, I think, very close to being a real issue.
There's a wonderful piece in Wired magazine about a standard surgery for people who blow out their elbows, as baseball pitchers are wont to do. That involves drilling out the bone and threading the muscle through it and reattaching it to the elbow. And one of the impacts gives you an arm like a pistol.
Right.
And people who pitch a lot of ball are prone to getting this surgery. And the majority of the top pitchers in the league have had the surgery. And the question is, have they been enhanced? Right. Given that the surgery actually does give you a better arm empirically, have they mutilated themselves in the service of enhancing themselves, or have they had surgery to repair an injury that would have been career-ending otherwise, and is an occupational hazard of throwing the ball all day?
Are there any drawbacks to this particular surgery?
Yeah, you have surgery, right? You get a hole knocked in your bone. You get a muscle, regrafted. You have to take meds. You go under an anesthetic. I mean,
once it heals, does the arm work?
No,
I don't think so. You risk post-operative trauma and so on. I mean, sure. For example, say we said all baseball pitchers should mandatorily have the surgery. Some fraction of them would die under anesthetic, right?
Sure.
So yeah, there's a downside.
I think the connection with people's concerns about cyborgological enhancement and their anxiety about cheaters is a very interesting one. And it relates, of course, to a theme of my work, which is that I think one of the profound changes in politics in the coming years will be the growing demand for universal equal access to these technologies in order to prevent the exacerbation of inequality that would result if they're unequally distributed by the market. And as a consequence, I think that we're going to have, for instance, demands within healthcare systems that healthcare systems be in the United States universal. Right now, if you only have, don't have health insurance, you have about a 5-year gap in your life expectancy, but it could be 10, 15, 20, 30 years in the future, more. And that will create a much more powerful political and moral dynamic. Now, we've been able to put up with vast inequalities in the past, and we may be able in the future, but I hope that that's the dynamic it creates.
I'd like to mention also that a lot of these implants, we're talking the retina implant and the bionic ear implants are in $50,000 plus, which for us, I think as a group, we would start thinking about loans or some way of funding that. But for just the majority of people, that's an inconceivable amount of money that they have no chance of locating anywhere. So already it's you know, it's an issue. You read about these wonderful stories in the newspaper, but you know, who's really getting those bionics?
I do anesthesia for a fair number of them. And if you're talking about cochlear implants, we do them pretty routinely. And I'm not sure what the cost is, but I can only assume that the insurance companies are paying for it because we have an awful lot of kids who are coming through getting them.
But what about people who don't have insurance?
Then they're not going to get them.
What about the world majority who live on a dollar a day?
Not going to get them.
Right. Well, this gets back to the point about the politics embedded in technology. I mean, it'd be interesting to imagine if a workers' co-op in Venezuela was designing a cochlear implant, would they design a different cochlear implant? In fact, there are people in Cambodia and other places where a lot of limbs have been blown off by landmines who have designed extremely cheap, locally producible prosthetic limbs that are much more much more accessible than the kind of prosthetic limbs that are developed in the States. May not be as utile, but at least they're more accessible.
For under $100, I believe, was one of them, the one produced in India.
There's an NGO that just shipped a ruggedized solar-powered hearing aid for use in sub-Saharan Africa, locally produced.
Today on Change Surfer, we've been listening to the first part of a panel that was held at the Boston Science Fiction Convention, BOSCONE, entitled Cyborgs, After Man and Beyond. On the panel are Cory Doctorow, Robert Katz, Carl Schroeder, Charlie Strauss, and Alicia Kestrel-Verlager. Check back next week for the second part of this panel, or go to IEET.org for the... You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.